Tonight on KPFT Local News at 5:30 p.m.
The society functions normally, okay? We are sitting in the cafe. There is a guard outside the cafe checking everybody. I have to point out the Palestinians are the weak side, and there the society has been much more affected by this situation. We can move around freely. For a Palestinian, it can take 4 hours or 5 hours to get from one place to the other. A few years ago, a Palestinian could come to my area, to my house, in 10 minutes, 15 minutes. Now it can take them 4 hours, 5 hours.
These stories and more from 90.1 FM, Pacifica Radio, KPFT Houston. News in a global context from your community, city, state, and region. With your hosts, Tanya Akpabio and Nadia Michelle. This is KPFT Local News at 5:30 p.m.
Good evening and welcome to KPFT Local News at 5:30 p.m. It's Thursday, December 29th. I'm KPFT News Co-Director Renee Feltz. Tonight we bring you part 4 of a special series titled Israel and Palestine, The Human Cost of the Occupation. This week, during the local news time slot, you've been hearing the series, which is produced by Pacifica reporter and medical student Seema Jalani. Seema is also a Houston-based reporter with KPFT Local News.
Rarely have two peoples been so similar to each other. I went to Israel and to Palestine in March of 2005 with a group called the Jewish American Medical Project, which is a division of Visions of Peace and Justice with Israel and Palestine. Our delegation consisted of 4 physicians, a child psychologist, 2 environmental researchers, an educator, an attorney, and myself as a representative of American medical students and also a media contact for Pacifica Radio. Our goal was not only to provide health care to those in need while working in conjunction with Physicians for Human Rights Israel and the United Palestinian Medical Relief Committees, but also to document the effects of the occupation on both the Israeli and the Palestinian societies and bring those stories back to the United States in an effort to better educate the public here. Dr. Alice Rothschild, co-founder of Visions of Peace and Justice with Israel and Palestine and an obstetrician-gynecologist at Harvard Vanguard Medical Associates, most recently has focused on peace and justice concerns in Israel and Palestine. Throughout this piece, Dr. Rothschild shares her reflections as she experiences the terrain from a Jewish-American perspective, while I, on the other hand, experienced it as a Muslim-American. The Gaza Strip is a 25-mile by 3-mile ribbon of land along the southeast corner of the Mediterranean Sea, home to some 1.3 million Palestinians and until recently 8,000 Jewish Israeli settlers. Including the military bases and bypass roads needed to protect the settlers, approximately 1/3 of the Gaza Strip was occupied by 8,000 settlers, while 1 million Palestinians were squeezed into the other 2/3. The Gaza Strip has a population density of some 3,273 persons per square kilometer, 11 times that of the West Bank. Palestinian residential areas, Israeli settlements, and Israeli military installations existed in close proximity. Even after the disengagement, the Gaza Strip is completely sealed off by Israeli military checkpoints, the most appalling of which is called the Erez checkpoint. The Erez checkpoint allows entry and exit into the Gaza Strip. It is the longest and most formidable checkpoint in the region's history. The entire area is dominated by Israeli watchtowers armed with machine guns and Israeli soldiers. Public relations director at the Al-Ahli Hospital in Hebron, Bashir, describes the typical day of someone who lives in Gaza and what they go through just to get to work.
He wake up at 12:30 at night to be dressed and to travel to the checkpoint, which is Erez checkpoint. This Erez checkpoint is the biggest humiliation checkpoint in the world, not only here. They have all this passage, which is 1 mile long. They go through it. They reach an area which they have pipes, like, you know, the cows when they go to be milked, and to be checked electronically. If they are not convinced, they check them by hand. They spend about 4 to 6 hours between here and to be out of this checkpoint. Then the buses, the Israeli buses, came and took them. They are supposed to be working there. You know, about four, the buses came back again and take them to the areas. They go through the same procedure, going in. They reach their home about maybe 8, 7:30. They have dinner. They saw their kids. They are so tired. They went to sleep and they wake up 12:30 to go on another day like this. That's the truth. You know, that's the life of somebody who lives in Gaza.
It took us about 4 hours total to get through the Erez checkpoint, and there were multiple stops along the way, with many computers, passport scanning, and many confirmations of our visas as well. Dr. Alice Rothschild reflects on her Erez checkpoint experience.
I was struck by how young the Israeli soldiers were. So I was sort of looking at this as, what would this be like to be an Israeli kid at this checkpoint? I was sort of horrified at the amount of construction, and they're building all these pens for Palestinian workers, and the imagery is of cattle. When I was talking with one of the Israeli soldiers who was, I think, was assigned to us as like NGOs, and he was completely unambivalent. He said, you know, there was a suicide bombing here last year. We have to do this. These people deserve it. They need help, but it's not our responsibility. And I was so struck by his complete lack of understanding of what it means to imprison a population. You know, once we got through all the paperwork, and there was this very long walk down this concrete corridor that was surrounded by barbed wire, and that was really creepy, and the analogy to prison was very clear. It was so funny because at the other end were these three soldiers, and we just walked by them, and they made us stop, and I was like so angry that someone else wanted to check another form. And then I realized that they were from the Palestinian Authority. It was just an irony that I forgot on the other end was the Palestinian Authority. And I looked at one of the soldiers, and he looked at me, and our eyes sort of clicked, and he looked at, and then he said, like Dachau, yeah? And it was so, like I sent a shiver down my spine. There was something evocative of that scene in this scene, although it's a totally different scene, that he had the sophistication to get that was just sort of stunning for me. When we left, I found it a bit more emotionally painful because we were with a group of, quote, low-risk people, which were older people. The way that the Israelis had constructed the pens was that you had to stand in front of a speaker, and you were watched by video cameras, so that you had no contact with a human being, which, you know, is the ultimate separation. And, you know, the Israelis would say this is to protect them against suicide bombers. For the people on the other end, it is very dehumanizing to stand in front of the speaker and lift up your shirt and roll up your pants and twirl around and be barked at by this anonymous voice. It was so painful to see these older Palestinian men, you know, with their little brown bellies showing, as they sort of had to show that they didn't have any suicide belts. There was an elderly man in a long jalabiya, and he could barely walk. He had a cane, and this man was helping him, and he had to pull the jalabiya over his head, and he was standing there in his little white underwear, and the look on his face was just devastating. And when I think that the few Palestinians that still get to work in Israel, which is a prized job, have to do this twice a day, is just mind-boggling, and it can take a Palestinian laborer hours to get through this with the same papers every day. And that level of sort of oppressiveness is really appalling. And the thing that happened to me that was very weird, and it happened to several other people on the trip, is that when we stood in front of the speaker and twirled around, the tone of the voice changed, and the man said, thank you, in a very civilized tone. And I suddenly had this feeling that he saw the Palestinians as less than human, but he recognized me as a white person, as a fellow human being, and therefore I got a different tone. The sort of juxtaposition of all these different images and the understanding that this is how you get in and out of this prison was very powerful and very painful.
After the ordeal of getting into the Gaza Strip, we went to meet with Dr. El-Sarraj, who worked with the Nobel Peace Prize nominee Dr. Rochama Marton as an ally in creating Physicians for Human Rights Israel. He is now director of the Gaza Community Mental Health Program, an institution which attempts to reach out to the Gaza community by way of trauma counseling, as well as many other services.
I'm working now on a project for the children to have sea sports. I want to create an atmosphere for the children to go and play in the sea, swim. You know, well, I've just been told, unfortunately, that windsurfing is not allowed in Gaza by the Israelis. It's illegal. And jet ski is not allowed. And boats are not allowed more than nine horsepower.
Yeah.
All these are restrictions. But still, we can teach our children to swim, to play on the sand. This is, you have to create alternative. UNRWA, the United Nations, refused to allow us access to school because the Israelis said, if you allow the school, you will be in trouble. Because they thought, the Israelis, that we're going to manipulate the children to be militants. They thought that we're going to use the children for political propaganda.
One of the workers there explained to us his personal story.
My sister lost her child. Her child was 7 years old. There was the Israeli tanks that invade the camp. I live in Khan Yunis camp. My son was standing behind, near this child. And both of them looked to the tank, how it looks. The older boys, you know, and the men don't look directly for the tank because they're afraid that the soldier will shoot them. Because they are children, 7 years, and they don't know what it means, what it the tank do, you know. And they shoot them, and her son was killed, 7 years old. His name is Hussein Abu Akar. He was killed. My son was psychologically disturbed, you know. He 3 days, he has nightmare recalling the event. I said that we lost Hussein, but we have to save Ali. When he started to complain and to tell me that he has dreams, nightmares about the event, I'm afraid that he will develop PTSD. And he is traumatized, sure. He is traumatized.
A student doing her postdoctoral work on trauma in the Gaza Strip explained the effects of the conflict.
There are still ongoing trauma that will last for a while, even after the withdrawal takes place. Being in a post-conflict period doesn't mean that we have just eliminated or got rid of all the effects of what have been going on for the last four years. So there will be more work with the traumatized children and with the communities, even after the withdrawal.
Later, we were able to visit the Jabalia refugee camp with Dr. Izzeldin, who explained its importance to us.
The largest camp among the Palestinian refugee camps in the diaspora. The population of the camp are about 100,000 people living in this camp.
Refugees from 48?
Yes. The tanks were here and they went inside the camp and demolished all of those places, the houses, as you will see now. The houses. It's shocking to see, look here, the walls.
And the people were in the houses when they were shelling them?
Yes, of course. Yeah, those are the campfires.
Yeah.
Yeah, the bullets here. All of this on the walls. This is a mosque. The walls of the schools, of UNRWA schools, it has been destroyed.
A refugee status is a legal status, but they then become official refugees that stay in the camps. The people who were deported and are in refugee camps in 48 and 67. They're two sets of refugees. They live in camps that UNRWA has the responsibility for them because they have refugee status.
The regular practice of Palestinian home demolitions and the uprooting of trees has had catastrophic effects on the population of the Gaza Strip. In 2004 alone, 1,304 homes have been destroyed, with approximately 13,000 persons made homeless. Since September 2000, 2,389 homes have been destroyed, making approximately 23,000 persons homeless in total. In addition, the Israeli army incursions have seriously injured water, sewage, and power networks. According to the World Bank, physical damage to the occupied territory water and wastewater sector from Israeli military actions is valued at about $140 million United States dollars. As of 2004, poverty rate in the Gaza Strip based on World Bank data was 65%. Those who cannot afford or hardly afford the basics of survival was 23%. In the latter half of 2004, approximately 63% of all households in occupied Palestinian territory were living below the poverty line. This means that over 2.2 million people were attempting to subsist on less than $2 per person, which puts them below the World Bank's globally defined poverty line. Refugees from 1948 and 1967 have been the hardest hit since they have been the most dependent on labor in Israel, which has, in recent years, been hampered as a result of repeated Israeli army incursions. UNRWA studies revealed that anemia rates in the Gaza Strip were as high as 54.7% among children and approximately 45% among nursing mothers. The rates of post-traumatic stress disorder in children in the Gaza Strip has skyrocketed in the last years. Approximately 30% of all children in the Gaza Strip have post-traumatic stress disorder, while another 20% reveal symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. Later that week, we were able to visit Rafah, the site where Rachel Corey, a young American woman, was killed by Israeli bulldozers while protesting the demolition of a home. There is now a kindergarten named after her in Rafah. Dr. Rothschild tells me what was going through her mind as she stood in the middle of the home demolitions in Rafah.
Rafah was where I basically lost it. I couldn't stop crying. I was so appalled at the level of devastation, and in the rubble was the toys and shoes and belongings of people who basically fled. The vividness of the bulldozer coming in the middle of the night, or the Apache helicopter and the mother grabbing her kids and running, and was so clear to me, and so intolerable as a, you know, whoever's idea it was, it just seemed so egregiously wrong. And you know, the number of people that were made homeless and more poverty stricken and all those kinds of things were so clear, and it was so painful. That's how I walked through the rubble of Rafah. It was just a devastating experience.
We were also able to go to a school in Gaza funded by the United Nations Relief and Works Agency. We answered questions and conversed with Palestinian students in a classroom setting.
Why do they think America is the enemy?
Back Israel.
Do they think it's the American government that's the enemy, or the American people that's the enemy?
The American government.
American government. Do they have any questions for us?
Why do you back Israel?
Why do we back Israel? You can tell them that we're a group of Jews who do not back the policy of Israel, and that's why we're here.
We're trying to get our government to change its policy of supporting the Israeli government. But it's difficult to change the policy of our government, just like it's difficult to change the policy of many governments. You could also tell them that the reason the American people aren't more in support of the Palestinian people is because they don't know, because our news media doesn't tell us. That's why we're here, so we can tell the people.
Why you consider Israel above law?
We don't consider Israel above the law. The problem is getting the government to obey international law. The government has chosen to refuse to obey international law.
After spending time in the occupied territories, I returned to spend more time in Israel proper. Our first stop after Gaza was to meet with a Jewish Israeli psychiatrist, Dr. Tristan Trudart, at a coffee shop by the name of Cafe Hillel in the German colony of Jerusalem. Dr. Trudart helps to organize peaceful meetings between Israelis and Palestinians in order to try to break down barriers and increase mental health within both populations with open discussions.
My mother was a Jewish from Romania, my father non-Jew, black from Martinique, and they met after the Second World War in France, and then they came to Chile, and I was born there. And I felt identified with the Zionism when I came here. I felt very strongly identified with the socialism in Chile, because that was the time of Allende and the socialist government in Chile. But I came to Israel before the military coup, the Pinochet coup in Chile. Some of my friends were killed. I immigrated to Israel in 1972. Mainstream political orientation nowadays in Israel is quite rightist and conservative. However, in most polls, most of the people are in favor of giving back most of the occupied territories. I think the population has been really affected by the occupation and mainly by this intifada. Right in this cafe, there was a bomb around 1 year ago, and five people were killed. One of them was the head of the emergency department in Sherei Tzedek Hospital, Applebaum, exactly, right here in this cafe. And me and my wife, at our daughter's school, 200 meters from here, and we sat down at another coffee. So for most of the people in Israel, going out to a shop or a cafe, it was like playing a Russian roulette. On the other side, the society functions normally. Okay, we are sitting in this cafe. There is a guard outside the cafe, checking everybody. I have to point out that Palestinians are the weak side, and there, the society has been much more affected by this situation. We can move around freely. For a Palestinian, it can take 4 hours or 5 hours to get from one place to the other. A few years ago, a Palestinian could come to my area, to my house, in 10 minutes, 15 minutes. Now it can take them 4 hours, 5 hours, and they suffer from bombing. Their children have a huge percentage of post-traumatic reaction. The percentage of Israeli children that suffers from post-traumatic stress disorder is around 10 or 20%. In the Palestinian side, is enormous. Around 40, 50, 80% of the children have reported post-traumatic reactions, bedwetting, nightmares. I was also a psychiatrist in the Army Reserve. One of my experiences with Israeli soldiers, reserve soldiers, and also soldiers in active duty, they themselves have very strong associations with the Holocaust as soldiers in an occupation army. Soldiers watching prisoners in military prisons, watching Palestinian prisoners. You know, several times I heard Israeli soldiers telling me that it's very difficult for them to do this job because they feel as Nazi soldiers, as German soldiers, which is a horrible experience for a Jew. In most of the cases, this didn't come from any ideological leftist perspective, but from the feelings that were aroused by the Holocaust Association. I've seen problems like this. They can be very severe. I have met, you know, psychological distress reactions in Israeli soldiers doing also this job as guards in the checkpoint. They feel their work is impossible. They feel very uncomfortable, humiliating people that could be their fathers or mothers or children. On the other side, they feel they need to do that for security reasons and that they have no choice. This is very important because most of the population is in the army. Till last year, I was a psychiatrist in the army. I remember a reserve soldier I saw a long time ago that really was very depressed and very anxious while he was a guard in a military prison camp. He told me that every time he stood on the watchtower, he felt as an SS soldier. And he had nightmares. He begged me, he asked me to free him from that duty. He had to do that. He wasn't ideologically a refuser or something. He just felt that he couldn't, he just couldn't do that.
One of the things that's so different here is that army life and home life are very integrated.
Yeah,
whereas, it's like I was watching
the soldiers in the bus that we came on. The women had makeup on and jewelry, and the men had, you know, funky hairdos and all sorts of, they looked like regular kids, you know. So it's not like you go into the military and that's different. It's a very integrated kind of experience. There are less boundaries. It was so wild because there were so many soldiers with these huge machine guns, I think, you know, automatic weapons, just sort of in the bus, you know. So I'm surrounded 19-year-olds with these huge guns, like, sitting on their laps, and they're dozing. You know, I'm like, wake up. I've never been around so many guns in my life, and it was just a regular old bus, you know. And no one was upset except for, I guess, Seema and me. Yeah, I know you get used to it, but it was so interesting to me that this was so normal, and that they're young, so they're in that formative time lapse when they're making sort of formative decisions about what kind of person they are, what they're going to do, and they're in this military environment, and then it blends with home. And
our society has become much more violent than before. We have had a big rise in domestic violence. Sociologists have studied this phenomena, and they have seen that since the occupation started, there has been a steady rise in violence in the Israeli society. Young people that are trained in an atmosphere of violence, and they are trained also to understand that the only solution to the political problem with the Palestinians is a violent solution, a military solution, I think naturally they become violent also when they come back home. We feel guilty working with our colleagues that live a different situation, and whenever we feel guilty, the associations of the Holocaust appear, because we feel we are on the wrong side, you know, doing with our soldiers, our society, the same kind of things that our parents and grandparents suffered in the past. Of course, it's not the same situation, but the associations appear all the time. I think one point of view that is very strong in Israeli society is that because we suffered from what we suffered during the Holocaust, we have to be strong and tough and never allow that to happen. If we have to be unjust, that is essential to survive. The other perspective is to say we as Jews can't do to other people the same thing that people did to us during the Holocaust. We were victims. We know what to be a victim. We can't be the people that victimize other people. Symbolically, it's not always a concrete thing. Sometimes it is.
You've been listening to a documentary produced by Seema Jalani and co-edited by Dr. Alice Rothschild. This is part 4 of a special series titled Israel and Palestine, The Human Cost of the Occupation. This week, during the local news time slot, you'll hear the series. To hear previous parts of the series, look for the corresponding KPFT news shows from this week when you visit the KPFT audio archives online at archive.kpft.org. I'm KPFT Local News co-director Renee Feltz.